Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Good morning. Today is the day. It is March the 20th, 2019. Welcome, welcome, welcome. These are this morning's verses of encouragement. Psalm 19, verse 1 reminds us, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 to 19, we are told that on the fourth day of creation, God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. Today is a good day to talk about the sun and the moon and the stars and the seasons of the year. Today is the spring equinox. It's also the last super moon of 2019. I know. It's called the super worm equinox moon. For those of you who have little chicken farmers like I have, the worm reference there indicates that God is likely to thaw the earth at this point in the lunar cycle, and the worms will begin to emerge, which if you are a kid who likes to dig up worms for your chickens, man, today's your day. So the March 20 spectacle that's going to happen tonight is going to be called the last supermoon of 2019. It's going to be visible in the night sky tonight, coinciding with the spring equinox, heralding the start of a new season. And I know there's a lot of folks out there that can use the start of a new season today. They could use the hope of spring. They can use a little encouragement from those of us who are not living in places that are today completely covered by water. And so let's be of encouragement today. To those who are looking at what should be the spring planting season and the spring calving season, and instead they're just looking at utter devastation across the farmlands of the breadbasket of America. And so we're certainly going to keep all of that in mind and in view as we discuss things today. I would encourage you to be people who point today to the heavens and to the one who reigns in heaven and the one who calls us forth as his people upon the earth to be good and godly representatives of the kingdom and the principles of the kingdom amidst the kingdoms of the earth. And of course, I'm talking about the Lord our God. He is the maker of all things. He is the sustainer of all things. He is the giver of life. And he is the one who even in the midst of the flood, he can redeem. He can redeem. So let's keep that in view as we move through our day today as the people of God let loose in the world. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm thrilled to be joined today by Kara Meredith. She is the author of The Color of Light, A Journey Toward Love and Racial Justice. Kara, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
So you have a really interesting perspective on these racial reconciliation conversations that many of us are trying to have today, but we don't necessarily know how to start having them. So how about you introduce yourself to folks and why you have a particular personal interest in these conversations?
I grew up in a white suburban environment. I identify as a white woman, European American descent. I fell in love and married my husband, whose name is James Meredith. He's a Black man. He's also the son of civil rights icon James Meredith, who was the first Black man to integrate into the University of Mississippi in 62, and who then led the Meredith March Against Fear in 66. And so my perspective and my journey, and then the book, is really a story of me coming to recognize my role in the conversation, it's coming to identify privilege, and also what that means in an interracial marriage, what that means with raising mixed race kids, but also what that means for every single one of us. Because it's not just for people who enter into an interracial marriage, for instance.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, those of us who are members of the body of Christ, we are in a family that includes Black and brown people. For Black and brown Christians, it's a family that includes white people. And the reality is we don't always know how to just have the conversations that need to be had. So one of the things that I appreciate is that you make this observation. Until we no longer have to have this conversation, we have to have this conversation. And so I think you really are uniquely positioned to help us talk about things that we really want to talk about, but we don't necessarily know how to even start talking about about these issues. So I'd love for you to maybe just begin, because the book is so filled with stories, and I think that's a really impactful way of communicating, because it like gives us it gives us something to point to and talk about. So introduce us to, and I may mispronounce her name, Keisha.
Kesa.
See, Kesa. There you go. All right, introduce us to Kesa.
Years ago, before I entered into writing and speaking and really began pursuing this as a career, I was in full-time ministry. So I worked for a ministry called Young Life, which some of your listeners might be familiar with.
I came to faith through the ministry of Young Life. So I have you're now touching my heartbeat. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you get that. And even though I don't then name Young Life, well, I just made it public. So there it is.
They've been outed.
But yes, Young Life has been outed in our conversation. But I worked for nearly 10 years for the ministry, and I worked most of the time I was working with kids of color. And in that time, I also met my husband. And so for me, I was coming into a place of racial awareness. And so this particular scene, Kesa, who is Tongan American, she and I hung out on a weekly basis. I would pick her up every Wednesday after school, and we would go get smoothies or a Starbucks Frappuccino. And so this one day we were just sitting on the curb outside of her house, and she was playing her ukulele because she's such a great ukulele player. And she just blurted out exactly what you said. She said, "I don't like white people." And I remember looking at her going, how am I supposed to respond to that? And so I said, "Well, Kesa, you do realize I'm white, don't you?" Pointing out the obvious. And it was one of those that, you know, had there been a camera or an audience right there, it would have been so interesting to then see her reaction and how she chose to then respond, and to see my reaction. Because she kind of deflected, maybe in an effort to protect me. And she said, well, you're different. You don't count. And yet at the same time, I don't think that I was at a place of realizing my own, just how I contributed. I'm trying to think what the word is, but, how I was part of that as well, because I was white. And so how I had contributed to, systems of injustice toward Black and brown people. So that was a moment of, yes, us being very blunt and entering into conversation. And that's the part of it where I go, what does it mean for all of us to keep having the conversations that we have to be having, even if it's uncomfortable? Because I think especially for those of us who identify as white, we want and we seek out comfort. And so if things are hard or if they're uncomfortable, we want to run from that. And that is so often the case when it comes to conversations of race, whether it's because we don't want to take the blame, we don't want to enter into things that are hard, we don't want to feel like it's our fault, whatever it is. Oftentimes we don't then enter in, when that's exactly what we all need to be doing if we're going to ultimately have first justice and then reconciliation.
So those are big, big words, justice and reconciliation. I think that one of the words that emerges in all of this is just simply the word love, and the reality that we're called to genuinely love one another in ways that in the past we've not intentionally loved. So we've been, I think the word that you might've been looking for a minute ago was complicit. We've been complicit in systems that have advantaged us if we're white. And we really, you know, you don't see it. If you're the person that's being advantaged, you don't actually see that. That's just not something you're aware of.
Absolutely.
And yet when we're made aware of it, we have this like weird, strange guilt, and then we get defensive, and then we're like, why am I defensive? It's not, you know, I didn't actually do it. And then you're like, well, the system, though, that we're all a part of is what we're talking about. And so I have found that a posture of listening puts me in a much better position than a posture of talking, because I often find myself saying the wrong thing. I'm just wondering how listening plays a role in all of this.
Absolutely. My motto is to listen and learn and listen some more. At this point, the book released a few weeks ago. And so one of the things that we're trying to do, we're maybe as in me, myself, and I, but also those who are around and who have been a part of getting this book released, including the publisher, what we're trying to do is to have conversations. So it's not then about the white lady getting up on stage to talk about race. Because if that happens, I miss the point, and everyone then listening misses the point. So what we're trying to do with everything around the book is to enter into conversations with friends of color. So we've had four events so far that have all been conversational book events in which we're talking about issues that stem from the book, issues of justice, race, and privilege a lot of times, but it ends up being a conversation. And what then happens is the audience ends up being privy to both of us listening and learning from each other. But what does that mean, especially for a white audience? That means that we sit here and we go, okay, my perspective and what I've always known may not be the only perspective. And so I have a responsibility to start listening. Whether I'm 39 and 11, 12 years old, I'll be 40 in just a couple of weeks, or whether I'm 82, however old I am, my job, no matter the color of my skin, is to listen and learn and listen some more, because that's how we honor the Imago Dei present in every single one of us.
So, Kara, you and I are going to continue this conversation in just a minute, and I'm going to ask you what the biggest misconception in the church is today about race. Friends, you're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I am your host, Carmen LaBurge, continuing my conversation with Kara Meredith about her book, The Color of Life, A Journey Toward Love and Racial Justice. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, continuing my conversation with Kara Meredith about her book, The Color of Life, A Journey Toward Love and Racial Justice. If you're just joining us, Kara, she is white. She is married to an African-American man, and obviously their kids are therefore mixed race. And the conversations that we're having are about all of that. And in the book, she is she's quite transparent. She tells stories on her father-in-law. She tells stories on her husband and her sons, stories of injustice. And that all then becomes very personal for those of us who are members of the body of Christ and care intimately for our brothers and sisters, regardless of the color of their skin. And yet, I think that, Kara, maybe that's the conversation we need to enter into, because I think the notion of being colorblind is actually not where we want to go. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I write about this in my book, but I think that's it's a misconception that a lot of us are still adhering to. And in that way, there was a colorblind movement. I mean, historically, there was a colorblind movement in the United States that took place particularly in the education and religion systems. And it was reactionary from the civil rights movement. And so a lot of folks said, okay, if we saw too much color and therefore had racism, then we're going to bounce and jump to the other side, and we are therefore colorblind. So one scene I write about from my book is being in the fourth grade and our principal standing at the front of the gymnasium and yelling into the microphone and then therefore prompting all of us to chant after him, "We are colorblind. We are colorblind." And I remember that moment distinctly. And as I later reflected back on it, I remember thinking, what would it have been like to be a student of color sitting in the room that day? What would it have been like, even if we were in a mostly white environment, to all of a sudden feel like the color of your skin didn't matter? And that's not just for students and people of color, but that's for every single one of us. So what does that mean now? What does it mean to honor the particularities of who we are? That's who Jesus was. That's what he did. He honored the particularities of everyone, including the color of their skin.
So, Kara, when we begin to talk about the misconceptions of race and racism in the church, what do you think is the biggest misconception about race is?
The biggest misconception? Well, I would encourage you to ask me and then also to ask a handful of friends of color. So maybe one of your next guests can be a person of color so that we have a diverse perspective.
Right. This is when I should tell you, like, yeah. We had Jamar Tisby on just last week on The Color of Compromise. Yeah. And so we actually talk about this subject matter a fair amount here on the show. And the reason that I really appreciate, though, your book is because so many people circle back around and say, OK, I am with you. I get it intellectually. I actually get it at a heart level. I don't know how to talk about it. I don't know how to end the conversation. And that's really what you're doing in this book. It's intensely practical. And it's pressing the conversation forward.
Thank you. Absolutely. And for your listeners, Jamar and I are doing an event in Jackson, Mississippi on Saturday, April 13th. So I'm honored to share the stage with Jamar in a couple of weeks, and I am so glad to hear that he was just on last week. As far as it goes with your question, and again, you were saying, what is the problem of race in the church? Can you remind me?
Right. Like what misconceptions do white Christians, maybe that's just what we should say. What is one significant misconception that white Christians have about the issue of racism?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's very easy for issues of race and justice and therefore privilege to be something that is outside the church. That I speak to a number of different churches, both evangelical and mainline, and we can stand up there and we can say, yes, justice is part of who God is. God is a God of justice. He's a God of peace. He's a God of love. He's a God of wholeness. That is part and parcel who God is at God's core. But a lot of times we can then separate the two and we can say, well, yes, but we are Christians. And since we're Christians, we major in the heart. And issues of justice, race, and privilege are outside the church. That doesn't have to do with us. We are not that kind of church. So I think the first misconception is simply believing that issues of justice, race, and privilege don't have anything to do with the body of Christ. So how do we then embrace these conversations? Because it's not just for churches who have justice as a part of their mission statement. It's not just for churches who identify as churches for people of color. This is an issue that is for every single one of us because this is who God is. So I think that's where we start, is by saying that this issue, quote unquote, is, maybe we even take out the word issue and we start at the beginning, we just say, this is who God is. And so that's where we start. And so we begin by starting to embrace these conversations again, even if it's hard, even if it makes us feel uncomfortable. It's not like Jesus was all about, you know, daisies and sprinkles. And I mean, those aren't actually in the Bible, but, you know, that it's not like he was about, the sparkly things that make us feel good all the time. And I think that's sometimes, what we can want to expect, from Christianity is a feel good religion.
All right, Kara, you and I are going to have to leave it right there for today. The book is The Color of Life, A Journey Toward Love and Racial Justice. The big idea of the book is, how do we actually navigate conversations about race? And how do we teach our children a theology of reconciliation and love? Kara, thank you so much for being with us here today on Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you, Carmen.
You guys can check out KaraMeredith.com for more information. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. So the headlines have been screaming at us lately about higher education, and we have been reading about
oh, you know, the latest round of naughtiness related to higher ed and parents bribing to get their kids into elite schools. It has really pulled back kind of the thin veil on higher education and some of the practices therein. Hunter Baker from Union University is going to be here in just a moment to talk about the soul of the system. He actually wrote a book entitled The System Has a Soul, in which he deals with the need for creative destruction in higher education. And he's going to be here for us to talk about that. How is the church the soul of every system, including the system of higher ed? And how can Christians deployed into that system really bring about creative destruction and radical change? That conversation is up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
There is a term in the Old Testament, the time of Jacob's trouble. What does it mean? This is Jim Garlow. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7 gives us the answer. What is the time of Jacob's trouble? It's when something is being birthed. I know birth pains aren't associated with men, but this really has to do with birth pains, something like Jacob coming forth. We're in a moment of seismic shift around the entire globe. And spiritually, discerning people know something is coming. We're in the times of Jacob's trouble. Something is being birthed that's new. Every woman who's given birth can relate to the pain, the struggle. But finally, a baby is born. For Christians today, we know the turmoil and culture in the world are but birth pangs, as Scripture calls them. Christ is coming again to establish His eternal kingdom. It's just a matter of time. Rest in that. I'm Jim Garlow.
So joining me now is Hunter Baker, and the reason I'm now going to read his academic credentials is we are going to talk about higher education. So Hunter has a JD, he has a PhD, which does not just mean it's piled higher and deeper, it's actually a doctorate in philosophy. We're going to talk about what his doctorate in philosophy is in and how he got it. He serves as the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. He's a university fellow and associate professor of political science at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. He's the author of three books, The End of Secularism, Political Thought, A Student's Guide, and The System Has a Soul. The System Has a Soul has an essay in it related to the opportune time of creative destruction in higher education, and it's on that theme that we settle ourselves this morning. Hunter, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Okay, how did you get that JD and that PhD?
The JD, I went to law school in the late 90s in the city of Houston, University of Houston Law School. I think I basically did that while my wife was doing her medical residency. I think I did it out of self-defense because she was working about 100 hours a week, and I had to do something with myself. Then I did a PhD in religion and politics at Baylor University and finished that around 2007.
And now you serve as the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Union University. Tell us what a dean does.
A dean is basically basically coordinating the activities of all the different departments in their their college. So the College of Arts and Sciences is kind of the traditional core of the college. So I have the subjects that everybody thinks of, you know, biology, physics, math, English, history, things like that. I have about 15 departments and about 93 faculty just kind of in my part of the university.
So you and I do not normally till that soil when we talk together. We just jump into the conversations of the day. But today we're going to specifically talk about higher education. And so I felt like it was maybe helpful for folks to know that you have some credentials in this area. You've had a lot of experience in higher ed as a student. You've had experience in higher ed as a member of a faculty and now as a dean. And so, first of all, let's start with this question. In your view, what is the role of higher education in the culture?
Well, originally it was to sort of prepare the scholars of the society, you know, typically kind of ministers and scholars, and maybe physicians and lawyers, but it has expanded greatly to where, you know, now you have probably as many as a third, and that number is going up, of the population going on to college. You know, it used to be a real sort of special distinction to be a college graduate, but it is becoming a more typical credential.
So we now have a fairly large percentage, actually, of high school graduates. And I will distinguish that from people who don't graduate from high school. But we have a fairly high percentage of high school graduates who go on to at least begin an experience of higher education in a college or university here in the U.S. We have an extraordinary number of them who do not then finish a degree in higher ed. Maybe just share with us, because I know that in The System Has a Soul, one of the things that you talk about is higher education. When we think about the system of higher ed, what are we talking about?
Well, basically we have it. So at one time, you could go on and do almost any kind of work outside of a few professions with your high school degree. That has changed, right? The credentials that are typically needed, and whether that's because of the way the human resources regulations have been written by various companies or promotion schedules or whatever else, it has come to be the case that if you want a professional career, what we used to talk about as a white-collar career in the United States, you need a college degree. The federal government is highly involved with that pursuit. So are the state governments. There's a lot of government money in higher education, and so that has become a very strong extension of our primary sort of system that we have.
And so we sort of have this expectation now in our culture that people are going to have the opportunity to pursue a college education, even if they are not actually academically or socially prepared to do so. Let's do this. What are a handful of things that you would like to observe about an incoming freshman in terms of the constellation of their skills and abilities, either academic and or life related, when they arrive on a college campus?
Well, even the nature of the incoming freshman has changed radically. You know, your standard, the thing you might be thinking of with an incoming freshman is the 18-year-old, right, coming right out of high school into college. But very quickly, what has happened is that instead of having just large numbers of 18-year-olds, almost all colleges are now serving the non-traditional adult market one way or the other. People who are coming back to complete degrees, people who are going to college who never went in the first place. And so the complexion of the college learner has totally changed. And with that, not only do you have a much broader swath of 18-year-olds than you once did. Once it was the elite, now it's a much broader, much more sort of democratic group. You add on to that a group of adult learners who did not pursue college in the first place or who pursued college and gave up. And so you have a different population in college. You have a group of people who want the credential, but who maybe do not have the same sort of academic expectations that you had traditionally associated with college.
How about you and I take a brief break? And when we come back, let's talk about this entire system being ripe for creative destruction. My conversation partner this morning is Hunter Baker. We are talking about higher education. He is a dean at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, and we'll be right back. So
So in the market economy we live in today, higher education is actually really, really big business, and it is a very big business that is under pressure from changing technology and certainly from the way content is now distributed, not only locally but globally. Hunter, when we think about advances in technology, and particularly you identify content distribution as a force of creative destruction now facing higher ed writ large, talk with us about the change you see happening and the change you see coming, and how, or well, maybe how can existing institutions of higher education actually prepare themselves for the creative destruction that's happening now?
Well, yeah, content distribution is a good word. I mean, the ability to learn things for oneself is higher now than at any time in history. You know, you pick almost any subject, and if you wanted to, you could, with the help of people who have posted content, educate yourself pretty well in almost any area. So what is lacking is that even if you did that, even if you did educate yourself and achieve proficiency, you still would not have a credential, right? So the question is all of that education, all that content out there that is not tied to any official credential, is there ever going to be a way that that informal system will be able to compete with the formal system? I think that may be coming someday. Eventually, people may come to see those things as equivalent. You think about in video games, people try to earn certain badges for overcoming various challenges or carrying out certain tasks. You could imagine a system by which people are able to kind of compile modules of education achieved in different ways and put together something like a degree. If you're in the IT field, you can already do that. There are certain certifications that you can put together, and that might serve you roughly as well as getting your bachelor's degree in computer science would. So that's what I'm talking about, this idea of kind of a parallel system of education compared to the formal one.
So the word of the day is going to be disintermediation.
Right.
Can you, Professor, yeah, tell me what disintermediation means and if I'm even pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, well, or here's another word we could use, disaggregation, right? At one time, you would have had lots of, you know, everything has kind of morphed into a university. At one time, you might have had all kinds of institutions like business colleges, which are not the same thing as you think of as a university business school, but rather a college that taught you certain tasks and skills, or an institution like a New Jersey Institute of Textiles that would narrowly train you in one particular field. We now live in an era where all the institutions have kind of plussed up into combo meals designed to attract federal dollars and subsidies, and everybody goes to those places. I think that what will happen eventually is that there will be a disaggregation, and people will be able to pursue those smaller, more concentrated units of training. Now, whether that's a good thing or not is a separate question. I think that it probably would better serve the different markets in higher education, though. There's a real challenge. I want to make sure I get this in. The challenge for the university is that at one time the university was seen to shape a person's character, to help them to become a certain type of person, not only academically but with regard to ideals of integrity and things of that nature. The way that the Christian college competes in this environment is through formation, right? The thing that I think about a place like where I teach, Union University, is that we're going to survive because of the type of graduates that we produce. And I know that this station is probably broadcast from another Christian university, but I think about our students and I think about captions over their heads, things that read, they would say things like believes in absolute truth, works as unto the Lord, treats other human beings as though they bear the image of God, those sorts of things. I think that as long as Christian schools are doing those sorts of things, they can survive this this current environment.
So talk directly to parents and other people who are influencing middle school and high school students today, and encourage them in two or three ways that they can better equip rising, students who are rising with aspirations of getting a higher ed degree.
The big thing I would say is to see education in terms of learning instead of just progression through life.
Mm.
Part of the scandal that we've just seen has to do with everybody being worried about, you know, kind of what credential is tied to their child's head and what doors that opens. Education is really about your development as a person. And so instead of worrying about going from seventh grade to eighth grade to ninth grade, you know, that's going to come. But the real magic in education is when you, the student, have the desire to learn. Nothing can beat that. If you have the desire to learn, then a professor or a teacher can do so much with you. And where you can go with that desire to learn, what that can become in your life is just massive. And it can affect all kinds of things, not just your profession. It can affect the way you live your life with your family, the way you run your finances. But cultivating that desire to learn is really one of the biggest things you can do.
And I would say curiosity and wonder, fostering insatiable curiosity, being an adult who demonstrates lifelong learning, framing discipleship as as the cornerstone of this conversation in terms of lifelong learning. I think that if we as adults in homes where there are kids and emerging young adults, if we are not voracious readers, if we do not have an insatiable curiosity and appetite and sense of wonder and constantly in the conversation, not only with the culture, but with really good books and literature. Like, all of those are ways to demonstrate, to be the curriculum of a lifelong learner. Would you agree?
I totally agree with that. I mean, to model continuing to learn throughout a lifetime. I mean, you know, how sad to go through all these years of education and then to kind of set it aside. Right. For a lifetime of Netflix or whatever afterwards. It's a wonderful thing to continue to have that voracious appetite for learning. And as you say, to develop that sense of curiosity and wonder that continues throughout a life.
I have a patchwork transcript beyond graduate school, and I am encouraging other people to adopt that kind of idea. And so, let's just encourage folks to continue your education today. By engaging some subject matter that captures your curiosity, that captivates your sense of wonder, and learn something new about it today. That's going to be the encouragement from Hunter Baker and Carmen LaBerge to each and every person listening today. Whatever you are wondering about, whatever you're curious about, go learn something new about it. Hey, Hunter, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We'll catch up with you again soon. So if you missed yesterday's episode, I would encourage you to go back to myfaithradio.com and listen to yesterday's conversations, specifically the conversation that I had with Ken Gruber of Omaha Rapid Response. Man, if your heart is not breaking over what's going on in Nebraska and Missouri, in Iowa, in Wisconsin. I mean, the scope of this flood seems to continue to grow. And Omaha Rapid Response
is literally on the ground, as are the Farm Bureau and others who are mobilizing. If you are a farmer or a rancher in the region and you're not yet familiar with the resources available to you, if you go to FEMA.gov, there, what you want to look for is what to do if your business or farm was damaged. And all of the resources are posted right there with easy access links. We're gonna actually have a conversation with Bill English this morning about family-owned farms, actually about all kinds of family-owned businesses and what to do when catastrophe strikes. Because family-owned businesses, particularly family farms, you know, they face real generational challenges on days like this. And so we want to have that conversation and bring the gospel to bear and give people some really good, tangible resources in relationship to that. So next up, Bill English from Bible and Business about the acts of God and what to do as a family-owned business in the face of it. We'll be right back. So the temptation to give up really has me thinking, what tempts you to give up today? And what or who are you then tempted to give up on? Because these things are connected. And so if you are tempted today to give up on your marriage, who are you really giving up on? You're not just giving up on your spouse and giving up on yourself. You're giving up on God, who drew you together and made of the two of you one flesh. And I recognize that reconciliation and redemption doesn't happen by one person's desire or willingness. But let me encourage you today, don't give up on your marriage if there's any possibility left of God's redeeming it. Don't give up on your kid today. Maybe you're tempted to give up on that kid. Don't give up on that kid today. Be the godly parent who is waiting for that child to return, even from the far country, and be ready to lavish them with the unconditional love that God extends to each one of us. So don't give up. Don't give up on yourself. Maybe you feel like you have reached absolutely your last thread and the end of the line. Don't give up. The difference maker, I learned this from Nancy Alcorn, the difference maker in a person not giving up and not doing the unthinkable, which can never be undone, is that they turn for help. And so if you are struggling today, don't give up. You can turn to your local church. You can turn to resources like Mercy Multiplied. We have heard offers even during this show today for you to turn to organizations like Teen Challenge. Don't give up. Never, never, never give up. And certainly don't give up on God. God is not giving up on you today. So please know that. Okay, ahead in the next hour, we are going to turn our attention to this college scandal, this college bribery, get my kid in where they don't deserve to be scandal. We're also going to talk about the Trump budget and what it means to be responsible stewards. And then I'm going to talk about the long goodbye, the Kara Tippett's story, which is now available on DVD. So whatever is frustrating you today or tempting you to give up, I want you to look it in the face and say, in Jesus Christ, I don't give up. I don't give up on God. God has not given up on me. And I am not giving up on whatever this issue or concern is. All right, friends, this is Mornings with Carmen. I'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.